Exactly 159 years ago, in the dirt upon which we are gathered, a man called Happy Jack fought and perished. We know little about him, not even his real name. But he was described in one 19th century newspaper account as a big black fellow, one of the pluckiest fighters in the stockade. Without the Eureka stockade, Happy Jack might have made a fortune on the gold fields, or, this was more common, scrabble to eke out a living. But he would likely have had a family, a handful of children, a classroom of great-grandchildren. He might have lived to see the dawn of the 20th century, to be there at the moment of federation. Happy Jack was fighting for a cause larger than himself, and so too were those who stood alongside him. They came from around the globe, from Canada, Württemberg, England, Nova Scotia, Petersburg, Wales, Scotland, Eberfeld, Prussia, Rome. 11 of the dead miners came from Ireland. The killing was brutal. After perhaps a 15-minute exchange of bullets, the soldiers were within the stockade. Most of the dead were slain after this point. Troopers, hot with victory, killing in cold blood, stormed through the mining encampment, setting fire to occupied tents, cutting at the injured, or fleeing and riding them down beneath the hooves of their horses. Llewellyn Rowlands was hacked to death by troopers over 800 metres from the stockade. A woman, her name unrecorded, was murdered, pleading for the life of her wounded husband. Eyewitness accounts mention Captain Wise bravely leading his men over the wall, ignoring the bullet hole in his leg. The same accounts describe Captain Ross, a Canadian miner, being killed after the action was finished. He died at the foot of a flagpole that held aloft a flag they called the Southern Cross. Some reports suggest 30 miners died within the vicinity of the stockade. Their bodies rent with numerous sword wounds, the final toll as high as 60. Without doubt, wounded crawled into the scrub or down diggings and died of their damage, alone and forgotten. The night after that morning, 159 years ago, a government sentry on a hair trigger fired into the dark. His bullet killed a woman and her child. We may never know the names of all those who perished. The Eureka Memorial just outside this place honours those whose names are known, as well as the other men and women whose names are unrecorded. And yet, those who lost the Battle of Eureka went on to win the war. Just 3 months after the confrontation, 13 miners were farcically tried in the Supreme Court for high treason against the state of Victoria. To loud and consistent cheering from the court's public galleries, Timothy Hayes, the chairman of the Ballarat Reform League, James McPhee Gillespie, a black Jamaican, Raffaello Carboni, self-styled revolutionary, Jacob Sorensen, a Jewish Scot, John Manning, a journalist with the Ballarat Times, John Phelan, the friend and business partner of Peter Lawler, Thomas Dignam from Sydney, John Joseph, a black American, Jan Venick from the Netherlands, and the Irishman, James Beattie, William Molloy, Michael Twowey and Henry Reid were all acquitted by juries that generally deliberated no more than 30 minutes. Indeed, John Joseph, the black New Yorker, who was the only American for whom the US consul did not intervene, was chaired through Melbourne streets after his exoneration. And on the 24th of November 1857, Victoria's Parliament, alert to the democratic spirit of the goldfields, passed a bill granting universal male suffrage. All British male citizens of sound mind and record, 21 years of age or over, could vote for the Legislative Assembly, regardless of their income or property, so long as they could read or write. And they could do so by secret ballot. One of the truisms of politics today is that ideas that sound revolutionary today become conventional wisdom tomorrow. As historian Geoffrey Blainey put it, Eureka became a legend, a battle cry for nationalists, republicans, liberals, radicals, or communists, each creed finding in the rebellion the lessons they liked to see. December 1854 is a long time ago. A child born in Sydney in the early days after 1788 might well have lived to read newspaper reports as an old man of the events of the 3rd of December, 1854. And yet, it's not that far back. My great-great-grandfather might have glanced at the same article. And since his time, Eureka has been reinterpreted by successive generations. In the same way each generation feels a need to reinterpret Shakespeare or perform again the great rock ballads. Was Eureka a youth movement of an 1850s clash of generations? A revolt of free enterprise against the tyranny of the British Empire? An uprising of the proletariat against the Australian bourgeoisie? The first explicit flowering of republican sentiment in the colonies of the Southern Ocean? Was it small business owners protesting against unfair taxes and red tape? Was it miners demanding more efficient resource rent taxation? Or did it go deeper? A protest against burdensome taxation without representation. A bona fide Boston Tea Party on Australian shores. Whatever the interpretation, Eureka had a greater hold on the Australian imagination of my great-grandfather and my grandfather than it does on today's Australia. As Mark Twain wrote of Eureka in 1895, I think it might be called the finest thing in Australasian history. It was a revolution, small in size but great politically. It was a strike for liberty, a struggle for principle, a stand against injustice and oppression. It is another instance of a victory won by a lost battle. It adds an honourable page to history. The people know it and are proud of it. They keep green the memory of those who fell at the Eureka Stockade. And Peter Lawler has his monument. And in the 20th and 21st centuries, Australian political leaders have gone on record to agree with Twain about the unique resonance of Eureka in the Australian story. Ben Chifley, monument of the Australian Labor Party, wrote that Eureka was the first real affirmation of our determination to become masters of our own political destiny. Australian democracy was born at Eureka. Chifley's successor, H.V. Evatt, averred bluntly that Australian democracy was born at Eureka, and conservative luminary Robert Menzies constantly wove the Eureka story into his speeches and declared that the uprising was an earnest attempt at democratic government. Even John Howard, no noted lover of Eureka's ongoing symbolism, noted that Eureka was central to the development of Australia as an independent democratic country. Steve Brax doubts that Australian democracy would have come as quickly, and I suspect our democracy would not be as egalitarian without Eureka. Of course, it's hard to beat Gough Whitlam, a great Labor wordsmith, who hoped that an event like Eureka, with all its associations, with its potent symbolism, will come to acquire an aura of excitement and romance, stir the imagination of the Australian people. This history, this past, our past, isn't dead. As William Faulkner and Claire Wright have said, it isn't even past. The tidal wave of accounts written after Australia's federation is evidence enough of that. Unlike these names, the history of the Eureka Stockade is not set in stone. Nor, I think, will it ever be. The battle of the Eureka Stockade has become a battle for the Eureka Stockade, battle for its history, meaning and legacy. Geoffrey Blainey has compared Eureka to a great neon sign with messages that flick on and off, with different messages for different people on different occasions. And this is fair, because history has only ever been an attempted consensus of speculations about what was done beneath the morning mist and gun smoke. But what's done isn't what's seen, and what's seen isn't what gets written. Organisations of the left and the right both see Eureka as a militant struggle of protest against the entrenched powers of the status quo, a radical tradition to which some of them argue that they are the only rightful heirs. And I think the beauty and utility of Eureka exists in the fact that these groups, poles apart, can find vindication in the event's symbolism. But so can all Australians. As John Maloney has written, Eureka was a bloody drama of the human spirit. Their deaths and the symbolism under which they died, the Southern Cross, now belong to the consciousness of our nation. Our perception and embrace of Eureka is about how we see ourselves, our national fabric, our Australian essence, what we feel about who we are. Because history can't be defined, let alone owned, by any individual or group, particularly self-aggrandising extremists. Stuff them. They own Eureka as much as we own Eureka. We can elevate the Eureka Stockade to the central legend, the Australian patriotic identity, where it will embody the first Australian claim to the global ideas of democracy, freedom, republicanism and multiculturalism, enhanced by our national values of egalitarianism, mateship, and above all, the fair go. Every one of us can identify all or some of these ideals within ourselves. No one would unearth a philosophical dispute with the core values that became the basis of the struggle and can be all things to all people. The Eureka Stockade is Australia's greatest national story. Deserves to be acclaimed as the founding story, a founding story, perhaps the founding story of the nation. Because for tens of thousands of years, Australians have been constantly updating our dreamtime, our national legends, to reflect new information, new speculations, new interpretation. As the commemoration of World War I takes place over the next 4 years, we're going to see much of this discussion take place in the middle of our public arena. But I defy the pages of our history to uncover a But I defy the pages of our history to uncover a moment of similar transcendence as the Eureka Stockade, of similar power and suitability. The 26th of January is Australia Day, but it's also, in those powerful words of Paul Keating, the point from which we took the traditional lands and smashed the traditional way of life. We brought the diseases, the alcohol. We committed the murders. We took the children from their mothers. And we failed to ask, how would I feel if this were done to me? Anzac Day, Australia's dominant founding legend, lacks both the purity of motivation and the moral authority of the Great War's conclusion, or even the balm of ultimate military success that characterises every other nation's heroic military moments. The world went mad in 1914 because a Serbian killed an Austrian, and the major European powers could not or did not prevent the conflagration that eventually cost 10 million lives. Australia went to war without question, without hesitation. It wasn't our fight, but we fought all right. Our soldiers described their experiences on the cliffs, amidst the sand dunes and in the trenches, as fighting for their mates and not to let their mates down. Almost exclusively of the nations that fought World War I, Australia's major commemoration of that conflict is not Armistice Day, the 11th of November, the day the catastrophe ended, but Anzac Day, the 25th of April, the day Australia's war started. Unusually, we commemorate Revelio more than the last post. There's a message in that, perhaps. It's telling, too, that we focus so strongly on Gallipoli, an invasion that took 9 months to invade 3 miles at a cost of 8,700 Australian lives. An invasion described by a journalist in the trenches, Rupert Murdoch's father Keith, as a series of disastrous underestimations. It was one of the most terrible chapters in our history. And unlike Pericles at the funeral of the Athenian heroes or Lincoln at Gettysburg, there were no speeches from Australian leaders in 1914 that told us why we were fighting. There were no speeches that framed the coming cataclysm as a battle between right and wrong, a defence of inalienable rights owned by a free people, a fight for freedom. At best, Australia's Prime Minister Andrew Fisher, strident, shrill declaration that Australia would stand beside the mother country to help and defend her to the last man, the last shilling. Not enough. Never enough. However, the absence of a defining story or an oath for the ages highlights more starkly the gap in our national story. And if you're looking for stirring prose, I'm afraid you won't find it in our Constitution. As one of its greatest fans, Greg Craven, puts it, saying the Australian Constitution does not have a strong hold in our popular imagination is like saying fish survive better in water than on land. A statement so obvious as to be remarkable only because someone could be bothered making it. Unlike most any other country, Australia references only a military action as its day of national maturity. We do not turn to, we do not celebrate, we do not rely upon inscribed Australian words that establish our democratic soul. It's unlike the United Kingdom, which may look to the signing of the Magna Carta Liberatum by King John and Runnymede Meadow in 1215, that nation's finest democratic hour. It's unlike the United States, we can draw on three documents, the 1776 Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Constitution of 1787, in order to form a more perfect union. The 1789 Bill of Rights, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. And Australia is unlike New Zealand, whose National Day commemorates the Treaty of Waitangi between the British settlers and the Maori nations. Unlike France, which celebrates its nationhood on July 14, Bastille Day, when the citizens of Paris overwhelmed the Bastille Fortress and inspired the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. Men are born and remain free and equal in rights. By contrast, we Australians have no such documents, no statements of freedoms, no democratic demands, no organic recognition of universal rights. No common principles of liberty defined, transcribed, acclaimed, and prescribed. Except one. It was written here in Ballarat in the late spring of 1854. Its expectations were as clear, its motives as pure, the privileges it identified as universal. Its language as authentic and beautiful in its transformation of moral rights into political demands as any that I have just mentioned. It was the democratic sum of all establishment fears, and it licked the touch paper of the fuse that exploded in these hills in the waking minutes of this day, 159 years ago. We have words. They are our words. They were written in Australia in response to Australian experience, and they were read in the Australian Morning Sun on Saturday, the 11th of November, to a crowd of 10,000 men and women gathered on Bakery Hill. According to Canadian miner Ophelius Boynton, the words were declaimed by men who took their stand on the platform, not to fire the people with a rebellious spirit, but a spirit of resistance to oppression, to claim their rights as men. They are words that have been inscribed on the memory of the World Australia Register of UNESCO. Words inspired by growing and, by that morning, irrepressible collective sense of injustice among the mining community. The community was beginning to realise that pickings on the goldfield were no longer as easy as advertised, and profit, if any, would be slogged out over the long term. There was labour for willing hands, but the chances of a liberal reward for that labour were vanishing into the mud. As Claire Wright has suggested recently, those who had emigrated in their thousands to the Victorian goldfields aspired to something different from what they knew, particularly from the hierarchies of home. Yet they also expected that the substructure, the traditional values and social assurance of law, order and justice would stay the same. But the substructure they endured was partisan and it was corrupted. For some time, the unfairness of the mining licence fee had been decried, a monthly charge levied by the colonial government on anyone who resided in the diggings, regardless of whether they dug, regardless of whether they found. 30 shillings a month, when the average wage was 34 shillings a week and a loaf of bread cost 4 shillings. And the infrastructure that the licence apparently paid for did not exist. Although there was a baby boom in Ballarat, those children were dying like spring flowers for want of doctors and hygiene. The police were underpaid, dishonest and abusive. And the licence, as Wright has identified, made poverty a crime. And the penalty for poverty was prison. The memory of oppressive and brutal hunts carried out by the authorities any time they chose for unfortunates too poor, too unlucky or too foreign to buy a licence agitated the mining community. The fact that miners, indeed anyone without property or serious wealth, were also disenfranchised, not allowed to vote or to buy land, was the deep-set offence. It was a wrong requiring an entire social realignment to right, but it was a realignment many considered fundamental and overdue. A series of recent events had fired up the miners, gathering dark clouds of strife above Ballarat. 1 month previous, miner James Scobie had been murdered outside the Eureka Hotel, owned by Nouveau Establishment entrepreneurs James and Catherine Bentley. When at the next day's inquest, James Bentley, the mining community's first and only suspect, was acquitted of any involvement by a magistrate not celebrated for his moral virtue, the looming discontent blackened like a summer storm. The fix was in. A week later, some thousands gathered outside the Eureka Hotel to vent their spleen. Heated by a hot, dry sun, fanned by gritty and menacing winds, fuelled by alcohol and pack mentalities, dissatisfaction became anger, threats became violence. The crowd became a mob and the mob became a riot. Flames were set to the hotel and it burned quickly and completely. Over the next fortnight, the arrest of 9 men in connection with the fire provoked 2 more mass meetings. These meetings agreed to the need for a league to protect miners' rights. Everyone who wanted to be a part of that organisation was invited to Bakery Hill on the 11th of November. At that meeting, men spoke, the crowd listened and convinced, voted the Ballarat Reform League into existence. The charter that the League then immediately adopted noted that it is the inalienable right of every citizen to have a voice in making the laws he is called upon to obey. But taxation without representation is tyranny. It committed the League to manhood suffrage, the abolition of property qualifications for the Legislative Council, and payment of members of Parliament, for which Sharon and Jeff and I remain grateful to this day. The Charter is the outstanding flare in our democratic consciousness. We have never been the same. Until that summer day, no Australian political movement had demanded or defended the freedoms that we recognise today as the bedrock of our society. The call by the miners to have their dignity recognised and valued is echoed in egalitarian principles we still espouse. The League's formation and political ambition electrified these golden plains. Its impact was acknowledged by an editorial in the Ballarat Times. This League is nothing more or less than the germ of independence. The die is cast and fate has stamped upon the movement its indelible signature. No power on earth can now restrain the united might and headlong strides for freedom of the people of this country. And we are lost in amazement while contemplating the dazzling panorama of the Australian future. We salute the League and tender our hopes and prayers for its prosperity. The League have undertaken a mighty task, fit only for a great people, that of changing the dynasty of the country. And Australians who, like myself, fondly hope for a day sooner rather than later, when Australians will come together to agree that Australia's head of state should be an Australian of merit earned, rather than a Germanic Briton to title born. Happily read in these words the first conscious step in the direction of Australian republicanism and Australian independence. A critical aspect of the Eureka Uprising is the strong strain of republicanism prevalent among the miners. The desire to create an Australian Republic and to gain independence from the United Kingdom owed itself to the presence on the goldfields of large numbers of Irish, Americans and Europeans. The Irish were Republican because of their hereditary hatred of the English. The Americans were Republican because of their own history of struggle against the British. And many of the Europeans bore Republican sympathies, having lived through the 1848 revolutions that swept Europe. But nonetheless, any Australian, Republican or no, can read the words of the Charter, can listen to their fearless clarity, and understand immediately their relevance to any Australian of any era, ethnicity, age, gender, religion, political affiliation, of any state, city or suburb. On the 29th of November, another Reform League mass meeting swore to defend from arrest any member of the League who was unlicensed, with weapons, if it came to that. The uncommonly collectivist, us against them, team mentality of the Australian goldfields was made concrete. And then on the 1st of December, in a moment of pure theatre, matchless symbolism, all the League members became unauthorised diggers as the disdained and disputed gold licences were consigned to the flames of a bonfire set in view of government camp, while a hand-sewn flag was raised to the top of a hand-cut flagstaff. A white constellation on a blue field, all exceedingly chaste and natural. The Southern Cross was also described as the Eureka flag, or the Australian flag. It had been sewn by Anastasia Hayes. The Age described it as waving triumphantly in the sunshine of its own blue and peerless sky over thousands of Australia's adopted sons. Raffaello Carboni, one of the leaders of the League, called on all miners, irrespective of nationality, religion or colour, to salute the Southern Cross as a refuge of all the oppressed from all countries on earth. Beneath the Southern Cross knelt Peter Lawler and swore on behalf of all of those who stood around him, "Swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other to defend our rights and liberties." They are as bold and brave a set of words as has been sworn on this continent. They're not a glorification of Australia's first invasion and defence of empire, nor are they self-congratulatory couplets from the founding of a prison nation. They're words galvanised by expressions of the universal human right to political participation and freedom from undemocratic oppression taking place across the globe. They're words that complement the continuing struggles for those rights today. Any citizen of any country could identify with these words, but citizens of this country should be inspired by them. That these ideals were a branch of a global democratic project is underscored by the polyglot menagerie that was Ballarat's mining community. Chinese miners were mistrusted and not invited. But otherwise, black and white Americans, Jamaicans, Canadians, Italians, Swedes, Scots, Jews, the Dutch, French, Germans, and of course the Irish, attended and voted and supported these words. And they voted as equals. So the crucial elements of the Australian experience were crystallised in the Eureka Stockade moment. Australian multiculturalism, Australian democracy, Australian egalitarianism, and Australian republicanism. Values many of us feel can't be separated from what it means to be an Australian. Eureka speaks to us positively about each of them. But not comprehensively so. There was much about the Battle of Eureka that was not iconic, and we must be wary of overinflating. The words, the Charter of Liberties and the Oath of the Southern Cross are outstanding, but it was in some sense, while it was in some respects multicultural, the attitudes of the European miners to their Chinese brethren is indicative of the deep and easy nature of Australian racism, still walking in the shadows of our society. And so too for women. Australia's suffrage movement was driven in large part by women whose formative experiences were on the goldfields. But Peter Lawler was not of a mind to extend the franchise across the gaping gender gap. Adult men were within the ambit of Eureka's democracy, but not adult women. In a conversation with the author that I did with Claire Wright in Canberra recently, I asked Claire how she thought Peter Lawler would have felt if he'd known that Australia's first female Prime Minister would be the member for Lawler. Claire replied, "I don't think he would have been very happy about it." And sadly too, Lawler's legacy as a democratic firebrand is also besmirched by his actions after he was elected to Parliament, following the great political reforms catalysed by the Eureka Stockade. In the Victorian Parliament, he voted against a bill to introduce universal white male suffrage in Victoria, voted for a land bill that explicitly protected the rights of the rich over the requirements of the underclass, and used low-paid Chinese workers as strikebreakers at a mine where he was a director. Eureka's a great symbol, but it's not a perfect one. And that's true of other stories too. Indeed, in my first speech, I talked about how the Australian Labor Party was the rightful heir to Deakin's model of social liberalism. But I had to admit at the time that there's not much that's liberal in Deakin's defence of white Australia and trade protectionism. Eureka too has its limits. So goes the human condition. But although the Battle of the Eureka Stockade was not a major armed rebellion, at different times by different people, it's been compared to the Civil War of the English, the Revolution of the French, the United States War of Independence. It's important to accept that much as we seem drawn to victorious deeds and glorious combat, the brief struggle within the Eureka Stockade and the following unheroic massacre was not our Marston Moor, our Bunker Hill, our Bastille moment. The accusing memories of Pemmel Woolley and Yagan bear witness that this was not the first time in Australian history that a rebellion was led in defence of a people's right to self-determination. The smug orchestrators of the Rum Rebellion preceded and succeeded in their coup d'etat, while the dead Irish convicts of Castle Hill can attest to the first revolt of white men against the wickedness of colonial authorities. To quote Claire Wright, the miners were not disloyal to their sovereign, but rather had lost any respect for the minions who served her. They did not want to change the system of government, they wanted to be included in it. Those rights they considered were nothing more or less than their entitlement as free-born Britons to be treated like men. Not animals, serfs or slaves, men. They sewed a flag and they built a fence. And, I could add to Claire's words, they were thumped into next week by the government. And that's all. The core ideals expressed in the Charter and the Oath stand in comparison to anything similar. But the fight to defend them cannot, even though some of us might wish our founding principles baptised in gouts of gold-flecked blood. Tragically and terribly, blood was spilt in the Ballarat dirt. But it was the oath sworn to the southern stars that should ignite our imagination. Indeed, the events around the Eureka Stockade and the reaction to it now and then bespeak a curiously Australian style of political revolt. It knits together unique, instantly recognisable themes of the Australian national character in a way like no other event in our history. For instance, our little acknowledged but overriding respect for the security offered by the state. As the Eureka kettle began to boil, the majority of Victorian citizenry expected the authorities to take control of the situation. Despite the violence, the majority of the citizenry applauded the authorities when they did. The state was safe. But when it was clear that the revolt had been defeated and the status quo restored, the people embraced an opportunity to demonstrate what has been proven to be our compulsive Australian support for the underdog. And then when the state was safe but the underdogs triumphant, thoughts turned on the question raised by the losers of this civic brawl, namely whether a civil society was required to recognise democratic rights and needed relatively inclusive representative government. Society answered these questions quickly, in legislative terms, breathtakingly so, considering that it was not the establishment who were set to most benefit from political reform. But that Australian characteristic, today absolute, our commitment to democracy for everyone, eventually, was born in the mass public support, which brooked no obstruction. In 1857, a series of laws had been passed in Westminster and Melbourne that provided every white male with a vote in elections in the Victorian Legislative Assembly. The second male democracy in Australia after South Australia, and the first with convict heritage. And the licence fee became a mining right. 30 shillings a month became 20 shillings, £1 a year. Compare that to England, the United States, France, and New Zealand, where goodwill and peace to all humankind was not the immediate manifest consequence the people of those countries had desired when they identified and wrote down common rights of humanity. France consumed itself in the reign of terror within 5 years of the Declaration of the Rights of Man, the same span it took the New Zealand Wars to erupt after Waitangi. England was riven by a civil war in the 1640s and 1650s and took a toll of a greater proportion of the population than did World War I. And Britain did not consider its female population mature enough to vote until 1928, while 47 years after the fathers of the United States brought forth from the North American continent a new nation conceived in liberty, dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, the citizens of that nation were engaged in a great civil war, testing whether it or any nation so conceived could long endure. And it was a lifetime further after that, 1920, that women took the vote in the United States. Yet since the 1903 federal election, Australian women have had the right to vote and stand for office. If that's how you define a democracy, Australia is the world's first democracy. An Australia sparked by the beautiful ideals expressed in Eureka, but not riven by the scale or nature of their proving, very quickly became the very model of a modern democracy. As a result of the political reforms ushered in by Eureka, notes Peter Fitzsimons, Australia became nothing less than one of the key lights on the hill for democratic movements around the world, most particularly when it came to the secret ballot, known as the Australian ballot. This country would remain at the forefront of those reforms for decades to come. It's hard work in this, the same hard work done by the men and women on the Eureka diggings, unrelenting, unforgiving. Hard work undertaken with no guarantee of ultimate success, but with every hope of improving the future of themselves, their families, their communities, and their society. Hard work that continues. But there's some luck too. Economic historian Ian McLean points out that maybe only for reasons of administrative simplicity, the colonial authorities initially chose to prescribe an extremely small claim size for gold miners, just 8 feet by 8 feet. And that spread the lottery of gold mining across a large group of self-employed miners, who then helped spur the transition to democracy. There's another alternative, another road we didn't take, of larger claim sizes in which the mining was done by wage labour. Under that counterfactual, our history might have looked a lot like a dozen resource-cursed autocracies around the globe. No story, no myth or legend is static, least of all our history at the Eureka Stockade. To see the ideals of Eureka thrive, we need to be open to all interpretation of these events, the old and the new. To be open to the idea, in fact, to encourage the idea that principles of freedom, of fairness, of democracy, written down and sworn to beneath the timeless Southern Cross sparkling atop Bakery Hill, that those principles can and do mean different things to different people. G.K. Chesterton once said, "Tradition is the democracy of the dead." It's our way of giving votes to our ancestors. And quoting these words, British Labour MP John Cruddas gently rebukes progressives for far too easily scorning tradition. "We must," Cruddas argued, "respect the struggles and sacrifices of those who've gone before." And so there's nothing conservative, nothing nostalgic about a love of history and tradition. I take it as read that the Eureka Principles will always mean something to all of us, to any of us. Beneath the turbulence, anger and fear, and the stark commitment gone beyond class, race or gender, as the first gunshots burn the dawn stillness, we can each of us, all of us, stand there in the morning fog and we can know what we stand for and what we stood for. For an idea that continues to epitomise Australia's success, safety and ambition in a world often beset by a sea of troubles. An idea born in Ballarat that our nation lives and defends. An idea, the idea, undeniable, reliable and precious, that beneath our radiant Southern Cross we can and will advance. Thank you.